If we look at halacha and shelot and shuvot questions, the questions that people ask inform us about what they were thinking about and what was going on in society at that time. And people study history sometimes through these questions and answers between the people and the rabbis. And I found this fascinating sefer from Rav Bezalel Zev Safran. And this is a rabbi from Romania. And there's just like the questions that are asked kind of inform us of what was going on in the world at that time. And the first question that we're going to look at three different questions to try to give us insight into the Romanian Jewish community and perhaps a little bit broader in terms of the European Jewish community. The first question that was asked, I mean, it's in front of you, but I'll loosely translate as we go. He was asked about an organization that was put together to support the Ukrainian Jews. Now, I'm not such a history buff, but it forced me to kind of start researching. What does this mean, that the Ukrainian Jews, what's going on? And I did my research and discovered, I mean, surprise, surprise to me, which I'm sure maybe to you wasn't such a surprise, from 1918 to 1921, 100,000 Ukrainian Jews were killed in pogroms. 100,000. This is like, it was, I mean, Jews were persecuted, I mean, through centuries, but this was one of the largest massacres of Jews in history, up until, obviously, the Shoah. And the rest of the Jewish world was shocked by this. The world was shocked by this. And the Jewish people throughout Europe were trying to go ahead and support the Ukrainian Jews who were persecuted in such a way. And what happened was, is in his community, there was this woman who was an influential woman, and she initiated a fundraising campaign where people were going to go ahead and donate money weekly to support the Ukrainian Jews, because they were in situations, he says, of plague. They were still being persecuted, they were dying, and they needed help. So this woman took the initiative and she raised hundreds of people. She got hundreds of people involved to start donating money. But the problem was, is that after time, the ability to transfer the money became problematic. And the money kept on accumulating, and the ability to transfer it wasn't happening, and they found themselves sitting on a very large sum of money. And it wasn't going to Ukraine. So the members of this community organization decided, well, let's take a vote. What should we do with the money? And they took a vote, and I guess the majority decided, let's go ahead and found a school, a Jewish school in Romania. And when this woman heard about what was happening to her initiative, she was not so thrilled. She says, this is not what the money was raised for. We raised this money to support the Ukrainian Jews, and we need to get that money there. And the fact that you voted, that doesn't give you the right. The people who gave this money, it was earmarked. And we don't want to have this money go and used. I mean, Jewish education is great, don't get me wrong, but I mean, saving the Ukrainian Jews was even more important. So this question came in front of the rabbi, and he had to go ahead and decide what to do. So after weighing the decision, you can imagine, but I mean, he thought about it. I mean, Torah is important, but he said, listen, I mean, I saved, if anybody wants to research it, you'll have to look it up. I kind of cut to the end. Sometimes, like, you know, people, if you're impatient in terms of the shelot and shuvot, you can always just read to the end and you'll get the answer if you don't want to go through the whole process. But cutting to the end, he says, sof davar, at the end, he says, it's chalila, it's terrible. How could you possibly go ahead and take this money away from the Ukrainian Jews who need it? We'll find another way to get that money. We will go ahead and we'll find other organizations to transfer the money. I guess you couldn't wire the money as easily in those days, right? And we're going to make sure that the Ukrainian Jews are going to get their money, and that's what was going to happen. But again, from this tshuva, it's fascinating to see, first of all, again, persecution for the Jewish people. Again, the Holocaust is so large that sometimes it, for me, in terms of my education, it overshadowed this, which would also have been a tragedy of immense scale. 100,000 Jews in 3 years is unheard of, but I mean 6 million in 5 is also unheard of, right? But I'm saying, but that kind of like overshadowed the other tragedies. So I'm saying that this was going on in the world was nothing new, and again, this was like almost like a precursor to what eventually happened. Also, what's interesting, again, in terms of the Jewish world, is again that this idea of awareness of the rest of the world and support. In other words, this idea of interconnectedness. But also fascinating, as a bit of an aside, is again the initiative of this woman, right? That it was that again that this woman had double initiative. That on the one hand, she was the one who spearheaded this fundraising campaign. And on the other hand, she was also the one who stood up and said, you can't go ahead and take over my initiative and use it for something else. And she was the one that brought this problem to the rabbi. Again, this idea of a powerful, I guess, proactive woman in the 1920s is something, again, something to see in terms of the Jewish world that was going on then. If we look at the next tshuva, it's a relatively short one. It's a question about a Jewish man from the Romanian army who fell in battle, and they buried him on the way. And the question was, what do we do? Can we disinter him? Can we take him out? Can we take the body and rebury him in a Jewish cemetery? That was the question. Now, from the question again, it's also fascinating. I remember when my when we were I guess packing up my wife's grandmother's belongings, and we came across this like a tapestry, like a big fabric thing, and it's a bunch of Jews davening. I think it was like a Yom Kippur davening or something like that. It was like an image of that, and they were all German soldiers from World War I, right? The idea that Jews were active members in the armies of Europe, and they were active members of society. And we see, I brought here, I mean, unfortunately, the source that I'm bringing is a wiki source, but nonetheless, right, it says that in Romania, like 882 Jewish soldiers died in World War I. 825 were decorated soldiers. Right? There was thousands of soldiers fighting in Romania, thousands of soldiers fighting for Germany. The Jews were integral parts of society, and as a result, I mean, it's interesting, they were literally fighting against each other, potentially, right? In wars. In World War I, you would have Jews on both sides of the war. But Jews were citizens of the world. And these questions of Jewish citizens of the world, decorated soldiers, what do you do with these soldiers? And the questions would come to the rabbi. So again, so this particular question, the answer was relatively straightforward as well. But again, a Jewish soldier, he's buried in a hallowed ground, like he's just on the side of the road. The answer is, yeah, we go ahead and we give him a proper Jewish burial. And unfortunately, again, we see the value of burying Jews in proper cemeteries. We see what lengths we go to make sure that even after a Jewish person has died, that we try to go ahead and give them a proper burial. It is something that is a value of the Jewish people, and certainly a value in terms of that time. And the last tshuva that I'd like to look at that he brings is also an interesting tshuva. He says that he heard this terrible story about what happened in the city of a intermarriage. Have a man, a Jewish man, married this non-Jewish girl, and they had, as a result, a non-Jewish child. He says, this is what happened. And the shochet, so I guess also the shochet is also the moel at the time, right? The shochet went ahead, similar tools, and he decided to go ahead and give this baby a bris. And not only that, he's proclaiming to everybody that this baby is a Jew. That is the situation that happened. And they're like, what are we supposed to do? Is he right? Did he do the right thing? Is the baby Jewish? And this rabbi is bothered for a couple reasons, which is fascinating. But one, what seems to be bothering him more than the Brit Milah and the Jewish nature of the child is he's really bothered about this shochet. He's bothered that this guy, he's like, well, he's so uppity. Who does he think he is? He's paskening halacha. You got to go ahead and speak to the rabbi. What is this? Who's this shochet? He's going ahead and he is, you know, usurping power from the rabbis. And it's interesting, right, in terms of this question. Again, his biggest issue seems to be, again, this shochet in a position of, you know, usurping power. The question in terms of the Brit Milah, he says, look, I mean, ultimately the baby's not Jewish. I mean, if the baby wants to be Jewish later on, they can convert and stuff like that. But again, what he was really bothered by was the shochet. And in his answer, he says the shochet has to go ahead and speak to the rabbi and ask for mechila. And the tshuva is really showing us a very interesting dynamic in terms of what's going on in the world, in terms of how the Jews are, getting out of almost like that shtetl mindset, right? On two levels. One, unfortunately, right, as the Jews become more emancipated, they also become more potentially intermarried. So intermarriage is not a new phenomenon. It's something that's been going on for ages. And they were grappling with this problem back then too. And this is one piece of the puzzle. But another piece of the puzzle, which is also interesting to see, is that the rabbis are losing certain power. Right? It used to be that you would have, like, you know, the rabbi of the community, and whatever he says goes. Unfortunately, we don't have that sort of power anymore. But whatever the rabbi says goes, and like, that's it. He's the Mara da Asra. He is the boss. Now the board is the boss. Right? The board goes ahead and tells the rabbi what the halacha is on some level sometimes, right? But in those days, like, this rabbi is grappling with this problem, because as time is going on, like, who said that he can go ahead and paskin halacha? Who does he think he is? I'm the rabbi of the town, right? I mean, there's a certain different dynamic that's happening, and he's kind of like trying to hold that line of the old world, where you see this rabbinical power in the world, and the rabbis are trying to like hold that their communities together, and he doesn't want to go ahead and have seeing halacha starting to go ahead and split. So he's trying to hold that line on a very firm way. So again, this tshuva is kind of like revealing to us, again, that piece of society and the undertones that are going on, both in terms of the idea of intermarriage, but also in terms of the idea of the weakening of the power of the rabbis over time, right? So, I mean, I would strongly recommend, in terms of like looking at these things, like if you ever have the opportunity to look at tshuvot, right, whether it is during the Holocaust, which is like there are like, I mean, we'll hear some unbelievable stories, like in terms of like what the people were really asking. I mean, I'm not gonna talk about your talk, but like one beautiful like tshuva, I was like, I taught a class in terms of halacha about, like, you know, the nature of brachot. You say, you know, al, you know, lahadlik ner or al hadlaka ner. Like, what's the language? And when I teach it to the students, they're like, who cares? Like, what the language is? It's such a big deal. But literally, I found a tshuva where they were asking, we're about to die, al kiddush Hashem, Rabbi, what's the bracha we're supposed to say? Is it al kiddush Hashem or lekadesh Hashem? I was like, from the fact that that's a question that they're asking, it gives us such insight into the mindset of people. Questions that people ask rabbis are, I find the question is much more interesting than the answer, right? In that it tells us what is going on in society. It tells us what people are grappling with. And sometimes how the rabbis answer tells what the rabbis are pushing back against. In other words, in terms of the dynamics and what lines they're trying to hold and what societal values they're trying to see. So I think, again, whether it's the Holocaust or any other area of history, halacha gives us such an insight into what was going on in society from both perspectives, from the layman and from the rabbinical order, and to see what they're struggling with and how they're trying to go ahead and develop their society and guide them in a way that they think will be best. Thank you very much.
Okay, shalom everybody, hi. So my name is Priya Rakovsky. As Noam said, I'm a teacher in Bnei Akiva schools. And I just want to say that why I decided to come here, Holocaust Museum, to talk today, because I used to be a guide in Yad Vashem. I served there for my national service, and then since I came here, like, all the time that I spend in Israel, every time they're asking for guidance, like for madrichim, they need for Holocaust Day, they need for Asara B'Tevet, people that coming. So sometimes I went like to teach there, to give a hadracha in the museum or in different classes. So the Holocaust, like, it's here for me. So it's very important to talk about it today. Another small point before I started to talk, as you can hear, my English is not my first language, also not my second language. And I see some like famous faces that know that usually I'm speaking in Hebrew. Like, if you know Hebrew, you're gonna speak with me in Hebrew. So my English is okay. So if you don't understand something today, just stop me, don't be shy, okay? I'm okay, stop me and ask, what do you mean, okay? So let's start. So Rabbi Sonnenberg, stole my introduction about response in the Holocaust, about questions and answer that Rabbi had to deal with during the Holocaust. Yes, I just want to emphasize that the questions are telling us about what's going on and about what people care during the Holocaust, but more than that, about what happened in the ghetto. Sometimes we have yomanim, diary, thank you, and sometimes we have like a testimony. We have some stuff to know about what's happening in the Holocaust, in the ghetto, in the camps, but sometimes we don't have a lot of information. And where we can get the information from? From the books of the rabbis that published after the Holocaust, because in the questions that people ask there, they're giving the whole situation. We are in, and we are dealing with this one. So we have stories and like eduyot, testimonies of the Holocaust from the book, okay, from the halachic books. So it's very, very important for us if we're talking about Holocaust and if we're doing research and we want to know about the situation. And we are not doing something religious, but we want to know about the situation. Yes, we're going to go to a religious book from books from the Holocaust and understand more about the situation, okay? And so today I want to focus about the question, how we can say the bracha from Birkot HaShachar, Shelo Asani Eved. So let's take a look, source number one. Every morning we say it in Birkot HaShachar, Baruch Ata Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Shelo Asani Eved, okay? Thank you Hashem that I'm not like you not make me a slave, okay? And now I want to ask, in a situation that people feeling that they are slaves, people feel that they are not a free Jew, how can they say that? So I think that we need to now change the mindset before we start to read everything that we have from that, the answers, the rabbis and all of that. Change the mindset of what is a slave, okay? Slaves, sometimes we think that is someone that is working for someone else and cannot do nothing, okay? Like, he's in a horrible situation, he's a slave, like in Mitzrayim, we just finished Pesach now, right? And we're talking about freedom, about that we've been there in Mitzrayim, in Egypt. And what does it mean? Physically, mentally, it's so, so complicated. So I want with you today to understand what is a slave in a different levels. So let's take a look. Source number two, Abu Draham. He will explain us a little bit about the bracha, about the blessings that we sing every morning. So Abu Draham is a rabbi from the 14th century, a commentary for the Siddur, and he is explaining what is Birkat Shelo Asani Eved. Usually when I'm giving shiurim, I'm reading the Hebrew, and you're just following whatever you prefer, Hebrew or in English, okay? So, let's read. Source number two. Aval ha-shavui mevarech Shelo Asani Eved, Shelo tiknu bracha zo מפני העבדות עצמה, אלא מפני שאין העבד חייב במצוות כישראל ואינו ראוי לבוא בקהל ופסול לכמה דברים. So why are we saying שלא עשני עבד? And in general, the Abu Draham giving us all the meaning about all the ברכות that we have, שלא עשני עבד, שלא עשני אישה, okay, that sometimes, hey, what's going on? We're women, okay? So we have something more than like just say, Shelo Asani Eved, Shelo Asani Isha. It's not, okay, because I don't want to be a slave. I don't want to be a woman. It's something much more deep. And what is the meaning? That if you are Eved, a slave, you don't have to do mitzvot. You are like not commanded to do a mitzvot. And we want to do a mitzvot. We want to feel that we're doing mitzvot, we're doing halacha. And thank you, Hashem, for giving us the option, the opportunity to do the mitzvot. Also for women, thank you for not being a woman, that we're saying, you saying. So thank you for giving me more opportunity to do mitzvot. because we know that women sometimes has like not mandatory mitzvot. So thank you for giving us the options to do more mitzvot. So a slave doesn't have to do mitzvot. So thank you, Hashem, for giving us to do mitzvot. I want now to read with you the shoot, the responsa from Arav Ephraim Oshri. It's source number 3. I don't want to give too much information before introduction because, as I told you, all the details and the situation is here in the question. But try to understand in between the lines what's going on, what is the situation that we're going to see now, okay? Again, in Hebrew, following in the Hebrew or the English part, okay? Sheela, question. Be'et filat ha-boker, kshachazan, Rav Avraham Yosef, Hashem Yikom Damo, התחיל לומר את ביקורת השחר באימה ועירה. So, at the morning, when the chazan, Rav Avraham Yosef, started to say the ברכות השחר with a fear, he started to say ברכת שלא עשני עבד, and right away said, מיד קרא בקול, איך אוכל לומר ברכה זו בשעה שאנחנו נמצאים בעוצר ושבי? וחינם נמכרנו ולא בחסף? איך יוכל עבד לברך ברכת בן חורין בשעה שמות עבדות נתון על צווארו. How can we ask that? How can we say that? Like, thank you that we are not a slave? We are a slave. Like, we are in a situation that is like, it's a slavery. So, what's going on here? Okay, the situation that is a chazan one day in the ghetto. I don't know what's happening that day. Maybe he had something the day before. He stopped and said, no, enough, I cannot ask that. It's not true. I feel a slave. No, it's not true. Let's skip to the second paragraph. ככה דיבר האיש מדי יום ביומו, בית ברכות השחר. Since that day that he asked, every day that he needed to say ברכת שלא עשני עבד, he said, no, I cannot say that. And then they came and to ask what is my opinion about that. נשאלתי אז לחוות דעתי. It's הרב אושר that's writing that. האם יש לי מנה מלומר ברכה זו? We need to like not say that ברכה. Maybe just put it on the side for this time, for the Holocaust, for now, for our days. Maybe we will give up. ששנאה כמשקר לפני השם, ואז בוודאי שיש איסור לומר ברכה זו. Because they feel like they are lying to Hashem when they say that. And then, you cannot say that if you feel that you are lying. Like you need to say ברכות if you feel that it's true. או שמה, אסור לנו לשנות מהברכה שחייבו אותנו חכמים לומר. Maybe we need just to continue to say, don't stop on the meaning, yes, we are slave, no, we are not slave. We just need to continue what our fathers did, what our chachamim said that we need to do, we will continue. Okay, so what is the situation? The chazan said, I cannot say that. Then they came after a few days, because he said that every day, again and again. So they came to Arav Oshri, okay? Arav Oshri, now I want just to pause. It was in a ghetto Kovna. Ghetto Kovna in Lita. It was one of the ghettos after the ghettos that opened in Poland and all of that area. So it was later. The situation there, that it's much more common, unfortunately, to see murder and to see aktiot. Aktiot, actions, maybe? Like it's the same in English. So the situation is like the people feel much more intense the fear and they don't have a real life, okay? In all of the ghettos, but there it was like much more intense because it's open late. It's open when they came to Lita, okay? So we can see that the type of the question here, it's like Yeush. How do you say Yeush? Sorry?
Despair.
How do you say that?
Despair.
Despair? Okay. Yeah. They are much more despair. Sometimes we can open a responsa from ghetto Varsha and to see that we're asking about, Rabbi Sonneberg just mentioned, Leadlikesh, Adlakat, some small details. Here, the Chazan asks about a meaning, like, what's going on? Like, it's not just how I'm saying something, how I will do something. No, like, I cannot say that I'm not a slave. I'm a slave, okay? They're just enough, okay? So the rabbi said, okay, what can I do? We need to stop to say that because they're feeling that they're lying, or just to continue because it's our tradition, it's our nosach in the Siddur, and we will continue. So the answer is from Abed Rahab that we saw at the beginning. Bracha zo lo nitkena keneged ha'avdut atzma. This bracha is not because of the slavery, like actually, physically slavery. Ela ikar ha'bracha im mipnei she'eved lo yehudi patur mimitzvot ha'torah. Velachen gam shavu yehudi yeh chayav bracha zo. So when we're talking about Eved, it's not a Jew. No, it's someone that is not Jewish, that is a slave. He's patur. He's not have to do the mitzvot. But if you are Jewish and you are a slave or shavui hostage, so you have to say that bracha. Lefi muvan ze, sheikar ha-bracha hi lo al avodat haguf, ela avodat ha-nefesh, al kach sheyudin shenatun batzara ubashivya, הינו עדיין בן חורים, חורין, סליחה, מבחינת נפשו, ועליו עדיין לקיים תורה ומצוות. So, Rabbi Yoshri, here say something big. That we need to separate, to understand the, like, the difference between slavery of physical slave or mentally. Okay, you can be in a situation that you are a slave. But it's not your soul, it's not your neshama that is a slave, just your body. So if we said that, the Rav Abraham said that we say thank you Hashem that we're doing mitzvot, okay? Here now, Rav Oshri add something much more deep. He's saying, okay, thank you Hashem that we are also free in our soul, in our neshama, okay? That maybe they want to make us slaves, maybe they want to make us like to walk and to be like in a unbelievable situation. But thank you for being in a, like for being a Jew, like for being in a freedom mental mood, okay? לכן אמרתי לכל השללים, therefore I said to all the people that ask me, חס ושלום להם לבטל את הברכה הזו. חס ושלום. No, we are not skipping. We are not like putting on the side. We saying that bracha. עד הרבה, דווקא כעת חובה עלינו לברך אותה. More than that. Now, we are much more commandment. We are much more need to say that bracha than forever. Okay? Now is the time to say that bracha. למען יכירו אויבינו שלמרות שאנו נתונים בידם לעשות בנו כרצונם הרע, בכל זאת אנו רואים את עצמנו כבני חורין, הנתונים במצור ובשביה, וקרובה ישועתנו לבוא וגאולתנו להיגלות. To show them that we don't care. You think that we are your slaves, but no. We are strong. Our mental, like we are strong in our mental feelings, okay? It's not, you cannot break us. We believe that we are a free nation. And you cannot make us a slave. And you think that maybe physically, but no. We are mentally free. Now, assuming that a lot of you know Viktor Frankl, so I want to, like, when I read that, I said, okay, wow, it's Viktor Frankl, why? So let's say that Viktor Frankl is from Vienna, and he survived the Holocaust, and he's a... One second, I want to make sure that I'm saying that correct in English. Psychiatrist, okay? that he has his, like, way to look on things in the Holocaust and in general in life. And he has a beautiful book. Idan, can you show? I brought it here. That if, it's in Hebrew, but there is also in English, that if you never had the chance to read it, must, okay? It's not too long. It's beautiful about all of his way. First of all, it's talking about what he had in the Holocaust, the first part, a little bit of the, like, what he went through. And then the second part about his belief in psychiatrist, okay, about this way. Must. So, I want to read with you what he said. Most of his, like, books, he wrote some of the parts during the Holocaust, try or to keep him or to remember. It was a long story how he became like what he is now. And from that, we have a lot of information also about what's happened in the Holocaust. So it's a different way to know the details and how people went through mentally with situation in the Holocaust, okay? So let's read source number 4, again in Hebrew. You're more than welcome to following the Hebrew one. ניסיון חיי המחנה מורה לנו כי יש בידי אדם חופש בחירת פעולה. From the experience of the camp, we understand that each one of the people in the camp has a freedom how like to act. מצויות דוגמאות רבות, מהן דוגמאות שיש בהן מיסוד הגבורה. המוכיחות לנו כי אפשר היה לגבור על האפתיה, לדכא את הרגיזות. אדם מסוגל לשמור על שארית של חירות רוחנית, של עצמית או המחשבה, אף בתנאים נוראים של עקה נפשית וגופנית. אנחנו, שחיינו במחנות הריכוז, זוכרים את האנשים אשר היו עוברים מצריף לצריף כדי לעודד את רוחם של אחרים, כדי לפרוס להם מפרוסת לחמם האחרונה. In the camps, we can see that the mental freedom, it's something that it was very, very, like, bolet, showed everywhere, okay? You can see that maybe you're a slave, but you choose what to do with your bread, with your time, with your words, what to say. If you want to say something that will make someone happy or will take him down, okay? He said that in the camps, we can absolutely see the freedom of the how to act, what to do, okay? אולי הם היו המעטים, אך די בהם להוכיח כי אפשר ליטול מן האדם את הכל מדבר אחד. Maybe it was a little bit of people that decided to be like that, but it was enough to prove us that you can take everything from a man חוץ מדבר אחד. Just one thing you cannot take. את האחרונה שבחירויות אנוש לבחור את עמדתו במערכת נסיבות מסוימות, לבחור את דרכו. The one thing that you cannot take, and the Nazis cannot take on that situation, is to choose. From the hard situation, the situation is hard, the Nazis decided how the situation will look like, but what you cannot take, how the men can look and what to do on that situation, to choose, okay? How to behave, how to live, how to talk, what to do. Just to choose, okay? הבחירה. You can take him the time, food, energy, everything, like physically everything, but the power, okay? To choose, you cannot take him, to take from him. So I just want to, like, say one more thing to, like, summarize everything. This year, a lot of people came and said, yeah, this year we had a Holocaust, we had a Shoah in our country, so yeah, it's very hard. When everyone says that, I prefer to say, okay, wait. Holocaust is one thing. It was murder and something like much more big, and it was something that we cannot believe. And also what we had on October 7, it was something that we cannot believe what happened there. But we cannot compare, because this one here now we have as a nation a power to choose what to do, okay? How to act, how to fight, And in the Holocaust, each one of them had the power to choose, like the option to choose, but not as a nation. So when I feel in the last week, I heard a lot of like, yeah, and in October 7, today, Yom HaShoah. Yes, this year we understand more what is murder, what is that we're losing someone. But try to not compare. It's very different. And what is beautiful that it's different, that now is not just each one of the people can choose what to do and how to act in the camps or like how to be. It's we as a nation can have the power to choose what to do and how to react and how to be a like all agoim, okay, in that worst situation. So I hope also, I want to mention the hostages, that they are in a situation that we cannot imagine. But I hope that maybe they have the freedom of mental thinking, mental like way to feel that they can choose how to react, how to look on the situation. And Be'ezrat Hashem, today they will be back.
It's never a good idea to speak after your wife. I want to take it from here and maybe follow up a little bit and also try to tie it to maybe we'll close with also a bit of comparison, or not exactly, but maybe to October 7th. The question I want to focus on is how exactly can we tell the story to the next generation? We've heard beautiful speeches, beautiful Divrei Torah from Rabbi Sonnenberg, from Priel, about things that happened before the Shoah, during the Shoah, about resilience, about strength, mental freedom. But how many people are still alive around us that has number on their arms? And we need to ask ourselves, and that's a halachic question also, as we see in a moment, how do we tell the story to the next generation? How do we tell the story in a way that we shape the remembrance? How can we remember? And we say we will remember forever, we'll never forget. But how can we never forget something that we've never experienced ourselves? How are we going to teach it? And it doesn't matter if you're a teacher, if you're an educator, if you're a parent. How are we about to teach the Holocaust to our children, to our grandchildren, and to non-Jews who we know today are unfortunately denying in great numbers what happened in the Holocaust and what happened in the Shoah? I remember my grandmother used to say that she lives in Tel Aviv, and she used to say that when my mother grew up, and she used to take her to, there was a makolet underneath the apartment building they lived in Tel Aviv, and the storekeeper, he was a nice Jew, a very nice Eid, and my mother, she was young, she was maybe 6 or 7, and every time they would go down to the makolet to get eggs or milk, my mother used to ask her, Ima, why is he has this number on his hand? Like, what is it? And my grandmother, she didn't even know how to start and explain what is it and what happened to a 6, 7 years old. But this generation is gone. We don't live anymore in a generation where children are seeing Holocaust survivor in those great numbers. They don't run into them in the bus stations, in the shul, in the shtiblach, in the makolet, in the mall. We don't have this anymore. And creating a remembrance without being able to see it in our own eyes, without being able to ask someone who sits in front of us, what did you experience, is a huge challenge. And that's what I want to focus on today. And I want to do it using two very opposite perspectives, or two different opposite methods, but I think they can actually live along with each other. The first one is from the psychology world, and I want to introduce you to a psychology concept. Was researched by a psychologist, an American psychologist named Elizabeth Loftus. Maybe you've heard of her. She researched the idea of false remembrance, false memories. she made a research. She took a bunch of families. She asked one member of the family who, you know, she told him in advance that this is going to be a research, to give her some old photos of relatives, the aunt and the grandpa and the grandma and the cousin. And she cut the faces of them and she was able to, you know, glue them to each other and create like a new photo that has never existed before. And she put it like inside the album, into the photo album of those families. And every year she used to check it with her, you know, with the person that in the family, whether those people can actually recognize that this photo has never happened before. And at the first year, she said that when she opened the photo album and she asked them, okay, so what's the story? What can you tell me about it? People looked at it and they're like, I'm not sure I remember. But the following year, something changed. She says that the following year, people looked at this photo and they were like, oh, wait a minute, I remember. I remember that I think my auntie, she got me a special gift because it was my birthday. And the following year, they even started to talk about what they had for lunch. But it never happened. Her conclusion was that our memories, and it doesn't matter if for sure we believed in them, if we sure we remember, our memories are shaped and designed by the stories we tell to ourselves. We can call them false memories. We can call them wrong remembrances. But by the end of the day, it's just like the joke where, you know, two cousins can argue for weeks, how did their bubby made the special kugel? Was it with this or with this? How much salt he put into it and how much pepper? And he says, I remember she put this amount of salt. And the cousin says, no, I remember she put this amount of pepper. And maybe they're both right. Because she says the idea of how we create memories is by the stories we tell to ourselves. We should ask ourselves, how should we tell the story then to a generation that has never experienced the Holocaust? How should we shape and design this memory to someone who cannot remember it? Because he wasn't there. And I want to use, because we're just after Pesach, and not for no reason also, you know, Holocaust Day, Yom HaShoah, is right after Pesach, because there's a lot that we can draw from Pesach to Yom HaShoah. And we should ask ourselves, and that's what I want to do, how did our sages, Chachamim, shape the memory of Yitziat Mitzrayim, of the Exodus? Think about it for a moment. We all sat at a Seder just a couple of weeks ago, talking about and telling the story of how we left Egypt, but none of us really remember how it looked like. None of us. Nevertheless, for thousands of years, Jews have been sitting around the table telling the same story over and over again, almost like we lived it, and our parents lived it, and our grandparents lived it. But we didn't. So we need to go and check, what does the halacha has to tell us about how we tell the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim? And I want to start just to show you that I don't think the psychology world is so far-fetched from the Torah itself. I want to show you an example in source number one. You can take a look in source number one. We just read it in Shvi'i Shel Pesach, the delaying, the Kriyas HaTorah of Shvi'i Shel Pesach. We read it in Shul. So if you paid attention, you could see that we're told how Am Yisrael left Egypt. Take a look in source number one. We're told that Egypt pressed upon the people to hurry, to send them out. For they said, we are all dying. The children of Israel traveled from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 on foot, the men, excluding the little ones. They baked the dough that they had brought out of Egypt into unleavened cakes, for it was not leavened since they were driven out from Egypt and could not linger. And even provisions they had not prepared for themselves. We have, in what, three, four verses, we have three different ways of explaining what exactly happened, how we left Egypt. One time we're told that we were sent out. The other time we're told that we traveled. We're also told that we were driven out. Megorashim. But then, one pasuk later, when it talks about how Paro, the king of Egypt, how he hears it, take a look. It was told to the king of Egypt that the people had what? Escaped. And then what happens very quickly? And Paro and his servants had a change of heart towards the people. And they said, what is this that we have done, that we have sent Israel out from serving us? Right? The way we're telling to ourselves the story has a lot to say about how we react. don't know, maybe there was a reporter, a journalist, that told to Paro, you know, they escaped. Like, he wanted to have headlines or, I don't know, traffic in his website. And he was like, let's just change a little bit of the story. We'll see that, you know, they escaped. And not that they were sent out. And not that, you know, they were kicked out. And not that they were traveled. But we'll call that escape. And then we'll see, maybe people will click on this link and we'll enter our website and we'll read the article. So the way we tell ourselves the story, the words that we choose are very important. And not for no reason, halacha tells us, shapes us. How should we tell the story of the Exodus? How should we tell the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim? We say it in the Haggadah, brought in source number 2 from the Mishnah, Mishnah Psachim. Tells us, how should we say it? How should we tell the story of the Exodus to the generation that has never experienced slavery before? And in source number 2, it tells us that according to the ability of the son, his father teaches him. First advice is that we should know who we are talking to. Now, there's a lot of ways to explain what it means, the ability of the son. Some would say it's about, you know, how smart he is. But I'm not sure, to be honest, that's what the Mishnah means. Again, as a teacher in a high school, and again, most of you probably as parents, you know, that today, teenagers, they don't have a lot of, you know, it's hard for them to pay attention for long stories. Right? Today they're all on their Instagram, Facebook. Like, if it's not a 15-second video, they're already bored. Right? I think, may I suggest, again, and it's just something that I'm putting into this Mishnah. It might be wrong, but when the Mishnah talks about the ability of the son, it's not necessarily if he's wise, if he's smart, clever, intelligent. I don't think this is what the Mishnah is exactly trying to convey, as it is, you should know how much to speak. You should know what the media you should use to tell the story. The first advice halacha tells us is know how to tell the story. So maybe in our generation, the best way to tell the story would not be in the same ways of, you know, 1,000 pages of a book on the Holocaust. You're a 16-year-old, here, take, learn about the Holocaust. It's just not going to work. Maybe it worked for previous generations. Maybe movies on the Holocaust worked for 15, 20 years ago. Maybe today we need to rethink about how we teach our Holocaust. Right? Maybe today, I remember there was maybe 2-3 years ago, maybe a bit more, there was a project, an Israeli project, maybe you've heard of it. I think it was called The Story of Eve, of Eva. Oh, sorry? 5 years ago, thank you. Which was an Instagram page that I think there was a private investor that decided to do it along with Yad Vashem. And they filmed like a story, a real story from the Holocaust, just on a cell phone, and every day they uploaded like a short 15, 20 seconds video, like the girl in the Holocaust, it's almost like she has a smartphone, and she documents like a real, I don't know if you know what a story is, but like, you know, like those 15, 20 seconds of a video that our teenagers usually watch, and instead of watching a long movie like The Schindler List or others, they just see it every day, 20 seconds. And it became so popular, and so many children and teenagers were able to feel like they know what the Holocaust is, and they know, they understand what it really means, because we need to understand what media we use. So the first advice the Mishnah gives us is know who you're talking to, know the ability of the son. But there's another advice the Mishnah is giving us. Halacha teaches us that one should begin with the Jewish people's disgrace, bignut, and concludes with their glory. We should start with the negative and finish with the positive. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. Why wouldn't we start with the good and finish with the bad? Why would we start with the bad and finish with the good? So from a psychological perspective, you can also say that when you start with the good and end with the bad, you create tragedy. You create tragedy. And we don't want to create tragedy. We want to create hope. And in order to create hope, you always start from the bad and end with the good. You always start with the lowest of the lowest of the lowest, and you slowly go up and up and up and up until you create some hope for the children, for the teenagers, to know what happened here. And I think it's more than that. Because if we say that from a psychological perspective, it's important to know what we're telling to ourselves, to know what story we tell, because that's how we shape the memory. If we follow Chazal's, these halachic principles, we will be able to shape a memory that might last longer. And I'll try to explain. We learned this, that you start first of all with the bad and end with the good, from the way that Moshe himself told the Israelites, not those who left Egypt, 40 years later, the generation that entered the land, We know that the generation that left Egypt, they all died in 40 years in the desert. And the entire generation was switched to the next generation. And the Jews that entered the land of Israel, that entered Canaan, all of them never saw the Exodus. They never saw the split of the sea, Kriyat Yamsuf. They never saw the plagues, the Makot. They never saw Paro. They only heard of it from stories that maybe their parents taught them and Moshe taught them. So right before they enter the land, right before Moshe dies, he gathers all the people that never experienced the Exodus, and he wants to teach them, tell them, you should know what happened. You should have this memory, right? And we should, let's take a look how he does it. So in verse number 3, he says the following thing. You shall answer and say before Hashem your God, and we state in the Haggadah, my father, Aramiyo Vedavi, my father was a wandering Aramean. And he went down into Egypt and lived there, few in number. And he became there a nation, great, mighty, and populous. The Egyptians dealt badly with us and afflicted us and laid on us hard bondage. And we cried to Hashem, the God of our fathers. And Hashem heard our voice and saw our affliction and our toil and our oppression. And Hashem brought us forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with great terror and with signs and with wonders. And he has brought us into this place and has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. That's how Moshe decides how to tell the story to the next generation. Now I want to ask you, what is missing from the story? What is missing? What an important part Moshe is skipping here? What about Matan Torah? The giving of the Torah? Is it not an important detail to add? What about the split of the sea? I mean, we're told that he made those mighty miracles. But what happened to all the things that, you know, happened in between the Exodus and entering the land of milk and honey, right? There's a lot of stories, a lot of details that Moshe is just skipping. He's not even trying to tell them to the people. We should go back to the psychological research and tell us that when Moshe says this story in such a way, he's trying to shape the memory of the people in a certain way. And you can see, and I highlighted the words. Take a look how many words Moshe is using to focus on the affliction, on the sorrow, right? Wandering Aramean, dealt badly, went down, few in number, afflicted, affliction, oppression, toil, bondage. Okay, you can you know, remove some of those adjectives and add maybe something about the revelation on Har Sinai or something about the split of the sea. But why are you saying over and over again how hard it was? Because we shouldn't whitewash history. And I think when the Torah told us, the Mishnah tells us, the Halakha tells us, you start bignut, you start with the affliction, with the bad story, but you finish with shevach, that's what it means. It means that you don't skip the bad parts of history. We don't need to tell our next generation, our children, the story in a nice way. They should know what happened. They should know how bad it was. They should know the sorrow that their grandparents, great-grandparents has went through. But it has to finish with milk and honey. It has to finish with a sweet taste in the mouth. Baruch Hashem, we can do it today. We can do it because we have Israel. We have a sovereign country. We can finish the story of the Holocaust by not saying, and then 6 million Jews died, but saying those who were left alive were able to actually establish a beautiful country. A country of milk and honey. We'll take this model that Moshe teaches us and we'll apply it to the Holocaust as well. Because then, we're not going to create trauma. We're not going to draw people and our kids and our children away from remembering what the Holocaust was. But we might actually create and establish hope into them. I want to finish with this research that I saw from the Pew Research Center. Maybe you ran into it. It's from 2020. Take a look what it says here. Most Jews say that remembering the Holocaust, leading an ethical and moral life, are essential to being Jewish. This research was conducted on many, 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 many Jewish Americans. They were asked, what is prioritized? What is essential for your Jewish identity? And take a look, the number one, 2020, the number one answer, doesn't matter if it's Jews by religion or Jews of no religion, the number one answer was remembering the Holocaust. According to many, many, many American Jews, and again, it's interesting because in Israel it might be different. This is an American survey, right? I don't know what would be the answer in Israel. Maybe the state of Israel might be different. But for American Jewry, the number one, the most essential thing that defines who I am as a Jew is remembering the Holocaust. But the question should be then, what do we remember? What kind of memory? Because we don't remember the Holocaust. We've never been there, right? So what kind of remembrance do we have? What kind of memory do we have from it? And if you think about it, if you tell the same story, right? You take a group of people to Poland, for example, to the March of Living. Some of them, for example, might go to Poland. They will have really a meaningful experience. They will go back to Israel. Their conclusion would be, we need to establish more yeshivot. Because we saw what the Germans did to the world of Torah in Poland and in Europe. It's time to establish more yeshivot and to restore the world of Torah. You might take, on the same journey, different people from a different group, different Jewish group, they will come back with different conclusions. Their conclusions would be, no, it's not about the Torah, it's about Israel. It's about becoming Zionist. It's about supporting Israel, our own shelter, the only Jewish shelter in the world. It's not about Torah as it is about Zionism. You might take a third group of people from a different shul. They will go on the same journey in Poland. They will come back. What they will remember from it, what they will take to their own lives, is that we need to be better human beings. Human values, right? There is so many ways of remembering the Holocaust. There is so many ways of shaping, telling ourselves the story. The first step is to ask ourselves, how do we tell the story? Because the way we choose to tell the story tells us the halacha and the mishnah. The way we choose to tell a story will determine eventually how we will remember it. Will determine eventually, are we able to pass it to the next generations? Are we able to instill in their hearts the values, the ideas that our parents and our grandparents lived for, according to? And we'll be able to actually start with the good and finish, start with the bad and finish with the good. I wanna conclude and I wanna finish. I don't think, and I said I'll refer to October 7th. So I don't think, and if I can follow what my wife said earlier, I don't think there's room for comparison at all. I mean, I think there's room for comparison in terms of the sorrow that people felt. There's some families, including our family, that we lost a relative, that we went through sorrow that families in the Holocaust went through. There's families that lost older members, people in their homes that were burned totally. So from the sorrow perspective, of course people felt like they used to feel in 39 and in 1940. Of course, right? But the response, the reaction is totally different here. Totally different. Because we have a country. And we were able to start with sorrow, but finally we were able to see also the shevach. We're finally able to see also the good side of the story. To end with milk and honey. And we should be zochim that we will only have milk and honey and no sorrow anymore. Thank you very much, everyone, and thank you for coming. Sure.